payments are the foundation for the entire monetary and financial system. So to get global finance right, you need to get global payments right.
In this program, finding new ways of doing cross-border payments using some of the same technologies behind things like, well, crypto.
It's not the technology that is breaking down. It's the way that people use the technology. Yeah, so I'm Tobias Adrian. I grew up in Germany, but went to work and went to school a little bit all over Europe before coming to the US for grad school, where I started my work at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. I spent about 15 years in New York at the Fed and then joined the IMF 6 years ago. At the IMF, I'm the financial counselor, which is, you know, a kind of chief financial economist. So very much focused on financial stability, both global financial stability and country-specific financial stability. And of course, more and more work on digital money, payment systems, and climate finance. So it's a pretty broad portfolio and very interesting.
So in most countries, especially in the more advanced economies, there's all kinds of infrastructure in place to help the financial services sector take advantage of emerging technologies and innovate. But at the international level, it's a different story. Cross-border payments are as slow, expensive, and risky as they have been for decades. Tobias Adrian and his colleagues just published some research on creating a multi-currency exchange and contracting platform that would effectively transform the cross-border payment system. So maybe let's start with maybe a little bit of history about cross-border payments. And I assume that they've been around in some form or fashion for a very long time. But when did they, you know, become significant in terms of their role in the global economy?
Well, payments go back thousands and thousands of years, right? I mean, as long as people trade, they had to do payments. And traditionally, of course, those were payments in stones or metals. The mean of payment was very much related to the perceived or assessed value of those coins. And at some point, these gold coins and silver coins were replaced by fiat money. So money that is backed by the government, but is not in and of itself worth what is written on it. Mm-hmm. And so cross-border payments, of course, are more complicated because they involve the exchange of currency across borders. And there are many complications that arise in cross-border payments relative to domestic payments.
And the borders obviously have changed dramatically since the beginning of those processes.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, borders are enforced very strongly, and cross-border payments are subject to much surveillance, to laws, to regulations. So it's a pretty complex undertaking.
Mm. And so in terms of the cross-border payments that we use today, do they differ from country to country, or are there some actual, you know, international regulations or standards that countries need to consider?
Yeah, so there are different ways to do cross-border payments. So one way is, of course, to take a coin across the border and exchange it with a bank or an exchange, foreign exchange bureau. But of course, they then have to exchange those monies back. And so that ultimately involves the central bank at some point. And so the key innovation in central banking for domestic payments is that you can use bank reserves to make payments. So if you are banking in Citibank and I'm at Bank of America, we can make payments to each other because Citibank and Bank of America are exchanging central bank reserves through the interbank market. Mm. Across borders, that's not possible. So what happens across borders is that you also involve banks. These are typically called the correspondent banks. Not all banks are connected cross-border to each other. So there are perhaps 10 major financial institutions that do cross-border banking. These are the correspondent banks. And the correspondent banks are essentially a network of banks that trust each other. So if I go to a savings bank in the Caribbean, say, and I want to transfer dollars to Washington, D.C., my savings bank in the Caribbean will correspond with a correspondent bank that then transfers the money to another correspondent bank, depending on what the correspondent bank is, or the recipient bank, and then it goes to the recipient bank here in Washington, D.C., say, the credit union of the IMF and the World Bank. So there is a trust in the middle. So these two correspondent banks ultimately trust each other. But there's no central bank globally that allows you to exchange reserves across borders. And that is the main challenge in cross-border payments.
And so these correspondent banks, as you call them, are they regulated by some international body?
So they are regulated by the host jurisdiction. So, you know, these institutions could be, they're typically headquartered in the US, the UK, or Hong Kong. Those are the main correspondent banks of the world. Again, there are only like 10 institutions, right? Wow. We have hundreds of thousands of banks around the world, but only 10 institutions do this cross-border. So there are perhaps three challenges here. So one challenge is that it's only 10, so there's some degree of monopoly power. So rents are fairly high in this business. Mm-hmm. But secondly, costs are very high as well, because sometimes they make payments that are illegal and they get sued. Okay. And they have to bear the costs of that, which can be potentially expensive. And then thirdly, there really isn't a good cross-border regulatory approach. And that is because you have cross-border standards in countries, but there is limited. So the challenge in cross-border payments is a trust issue, an enforcement issue, and there isn't full trust among all countries in around the globe. And so that is another challenge in terms of cost.
So you've some of your co-authors have been putting a lot of thought in these cross-border payments and have written a research paper published a few months ago. And it was all about trying to, you know, harness some of the new technologies that have emerged in the past few years to help sort of improve those cross-border payment systems. But so what are the issues, you know, the most important issues or the issues that you're focusing more on this paper? And what are the technologies that you think can help improve things?
So there are two important ingredients. One is technology and the other is governance.
Okay.
So let me start with the governance, because that is not related to technology at all. And I want to use an example here that is a clearing bank, which is operated across about 50 countries. So it doesn't cover the whole 190 countries, which are the members of the IMF, but it's about 50 countries. It's a cooperation between those countries, and the institution is called the CLS. It's a clearing corporation for cross-border transactions. It has a very large share of cross-border wholesale payment volume. So payments that are large value payments.
But when you say clearing, like all the payments go through them, they...
Many, many. So an important share of global payments goes through that. It is very much around the dollar, the euro, and the yen. Mm-hmm. So it's the major advanced economies that are members there. But they have a very, very strong governance. So they have a governance where basically all the members have trust that the other countries are enforcing appropriate standards concerning, you know, making sure that the activity is consistent with the law. So there's identity verification, there are legal standards and regulatory standards that make it trustworthy. So anything in cross-border payments has to have some sort of governance that makes countries trust each other, that when they come together and do cross-border payments, they can receive them without fear of that being, sort of like
breaking the law.
Exactly. So that is governance. So the paper talks a lot about governance, and then it talks a lot about technology. And on the technology front, the philosophy is to say, well, we have seen important technological advances. But in, say, the crypto universe, those are not used for policy goals. They're used actually
to make money.
In some ways to make money and to undermine policies or undermine central banks in many ways. So can we use these technologies for policy purposes, for the greater good, as opposed to for some people who want to make money? And so that is the proposal, is to create a kind of cross-border platform, so something that could be operated by a consortium of central banks, where the IMF perhaps could play a role in terms of governance, but where other institutions such as the Bank for International Settlements, for example, the BIS, could play a role, or it could be a consortium of countries coming together. Ideally, of course, it would be a global kind of platform, but the governance around that is challenging. Yeah. So, you know, we don't have sort of like one vision for how it would work. We have elements of what could work. Now, let me expand a little bit on the technology. So there are three ingredients in the technology that are important that are being used. So one is tokenization of payments. So in particular, we envision a world where central bank reserves are tokenized so that you can trade these reserves across border in a multi-currency fashion. So tokenized dollars can be exchanged against, say, tokenized euros or tokenized yens in a way that creates trust. That's number one. Number two, we have heard a lot about distributed ledger technology. We have in mind a common ledger, so a shared ledger. It doesn't necessarily share all the information, sort of like identity information, like, you know, your social security number would not be shared across borders. But the basic information that each other needs to know to trust transactions would be shared. So it's a common ledger. And then thirdly, it would use smart contracts. So you could do not just spot transactions, but also, you know, state contingent transactions like options or futures or risk management tools. So something a little bit more complicated. So in principle, it could be the basis for, you know, sophisticated financial products.
Hmm. So when you speak of common ledgers and you're talking essentially about blockchain technology, which is, you know, associated with crypto, and cryptocurrency has gone through, you know, some pretty dramatic ups and downs recently, and the crash of FTX is a good example. Do you think that, you know, people are a little reluctant to adopt these technologies because they associate them with crypto?
Yeah, so the crypto universe has, I would say, fundamental problems from a policy perspective. So one is that many crypto assets are not tied to fundamental value. They're purely speculative, so you can see values go up and down. And that doesn't work very well for payments. Secondly, the consensus mechanism on these blockchains that are DLT blockchains means that you don't have finality of payment. So you never know for sure that a payment has gone through. No. It's very likely, but you don't know for sure. Mm. And there can be forking. So it has occurred sometimes that one payment has been associated with two different branches in the consensus mechanism. So that doesn't work from a policy perspective. And then thirdly, it has a lack of identity, right? So it is, you know, I mean, Bitcoin is fundamentally constructed to be anonymous in order to evade governments. And of course, from a government or a policy perspective, you want to have identity because you want to make sure that, you know, whoever makes those payments is responsible for the payments he or she makes. Mm. But the technology can be used for policy purposes. And that is what we are proposing, is to use certain technological innovations such as tokenization, ledgers, which are not distributed ledgers, but common ledgers, and then smart contracts in a way that works from a central bank, from a finance ministry, from a government's perspective.
Hmm. So you talked earlier about creating some kind of electronic money or a digital asset of some kind that the international community can use in the system. How, you know, with all these issues related again to crypto in terms of the public acceptance of this idea, how confident are you that we can come up with a digital asset that is acceptable to countries around the world to use?
So what makes me very confident is that we're heading in the right direction, is that the private sector is innovating and is already operating systems that are somewhat similar to what we are proposing. But the private sector cannot tokenize central bank reserves, right? This is not, you know, the private sector can tokenize their own deposits, but that is never as liquid and as trustworthy as tokenizing central bank reserves. So there's a role, there's a clear role for the public sector relative to what the private sector is doing. But what the private sector is doing is both in philosophy and technology very closely related to what we are proposing. And so this is why I'm confident that it is both feasible and desirable.
Okay, so the objectives of your research, as it is laid out in the research, are not simply about improving these payment systems, but I'm going to quote here. You say they're also to stimulate the provision of key international public goods and infrastructures. So how do cross-border payment systems relate to international public goods?
So again, so the private sector can do a lot. So here I'm not meaning the crypto private sector, I mean banks, basically. So banks can do international payments, but they do this with their own liabilities. So you exchange, say, a Standard Chartered liability against a Citibank liability. So there is some exposure in terms of counterparty credit risk. If those could make payments in their respective central bank money, so say reserves of the Fed against Hong Kong Monetary Authority reserves can be exchanged directly on this platform, at that point, you don't have this counterparty risk. And so that is the difference between having a purely bank-based system, even if it's technologically upgraded. And that's what every bank in the world is using, those new technologies to upgrade or do research on upgrading their payment systems. But they can't do all of it. There is a part that only the public sector can do, and that's what we call the public good, right? So there is the central bank credibility that is at the root of all financial systems that can create liquidity that commercial banks can't create in the same fashion, in the same liquidity, the same degree of trust, and the lack of counterparty risk. That's the key thing. And so, yes, there's a distinct role for the public sector here in international cross-border transfers. And it's not necessarily a very big footprint, right? I'm not talking about big government here. And, you know, this is potentially small relative to all out, you know, there are trillions of dollars of foreign exchange that are crossing borders every day. So what is crossing in central bank money would not necessarily be a large fraction of that, but it's a very important backstop for the overall system.
So are you talking about something that would eliminate that whole correspondent banking infrastructure?
It would upgrade the correspondent banking infrastructure, exactly. So major banks would still play an important role, but smaller players would also now be at a level playing field because everybody, all banks could have access to the system. There's a different question of whether non-banks could, and that depends on the jurisdiction. But banks could have access, so all banks could compete for cross-border payments, and so that should bring some of the monopoly rents down.
Okay. So it's pretty obvious that the world, the international community would benefit, many countries around the world would benefit from upgrading or improving these cross-border payment systems. But with all that's going on in the world, I mean, there's a lot going on out there in the world right now that countries are preoccupied with. How easy is it to get the international community engaged on this topic, and how can the fund help make that happen?
Yeah, excellent question. So there is a drive to improve cross-border payments. It's under the FSB. The FSB is the Financial Stability Board. So it's broadly the G20 membership. So it's the largest advanced economies and the largest emerging markets basically coming together on financial topics. And they do have a cross-border payments work stream where we contribute, the World Bank, the BIS, as well as central banks from the G20. Now, the fund is very important here because the fund is the only institution with a global membership. We're the only institution that has 190 members. So it's representing, you know, developing economies, emerging markets, and advanced economies. So it has a very, very global view. And so we are working very intensely on finding solutions. And so, as I said at the beginning, you have to get the technology and the governance together, right? So you have to have agreement on what the technology is, what is the minimal technology in some sense, and what is the governance around that technology. And both of these are challenging issues.
But with issues related to climate change, the war in Ukraine, inflation, all this stuff, when you try and bring parties together to discuss, you know, how to move forward on the improvement of cross-border payment systems, how much luck do you have?
It is a huge priority around the world. And that's, I think, for two reasons. So number one, payments are the foundation for the entire monetary and financial system. So to get global finance right, you need to get global payments right. And there's clearly an acknowledgement that we can improve. Secondly, there's this whole crypto universe, and that is threatening for many countries. So countries want to innovate to mitigate the threat. So you want to regulate, but you also want to put something into place that is more positive in some sense. And so the digital money revolution is very much driven by those two forces. So the acknowledgement that there is new technology and the threat that, you know, something else is growing. Having said that, of course, in recent weeks, the crypto universe has been collapsing and it might collapse further. But that just means that the way in which these technologies are used within the crypto universe are problematic. It doesn't mean that the technologies couldn't be used in a way that provides a public good.
Tobias Adrian, Director of the Monetary and Capital Markets Department at the IMF. Thanks so much for, you know, some insight into this new research on cross-border payments.
Thanks so much for your time today.
Look for The Working Paper on a Multi-Currency Exchange and Contracting Platform, authored by Tobias Adrian and his IMF colleagues, at imf.org. There are also hundreds of IMF podcasts with leading economists from around the world talking about their important research. Check them out wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.